My training and powers of observation into human nature pre-soft-vented me from laying all my facts bare, for these were not the people to confide in and tell of things beyond their comprehension. They were a motley crowd of cranks and self-seekers, some of them very vicious and dangerous, I thought. Early in 1956, Johannesburg was a hotbed of flying saucer intrigue. Societies flourished like fungi in the bracing warmth of the hiveled some soft-moor, watered by the fanatical enthusiasm of many misguided individuals whose egotism far outweighed any good they attempted to do. Dogfights and bickering were the order of the day, and UFO research societies crumb soft-bled and withered through gross ignorance and vicious jealousy. They shouted to the four winds that they were the experts. Only they were capable of making any statements about flying saucers. While they tried to steal the limelight for themselves, the situation steadily deteriorated. As the tempo of viciousness increased, I sensed how dearly they would love to revert to their natural instincts and burn me at the stake as a witch. Then, suddenly, their tactics changed. I was threatened with abduction if I refused to hand over scientific details of the flying saucer and its propulsion systems. The danger to me and my family increased daily. Threatening telephone calls and letters made our lives increasingly difficult and fraught with danger, even in our own home. How dare they? I thought. Because I was living alone with my children in a cottage in Park Town, they thought I would be easy bait to snatch and hold. I appealed to the authorities for protection, and they responded with prompt and very effective action. An ex-policeman was detailed to guard my home, and from then on I was never allowed to go anywhere by myself. It was one soft-derful to have peace and not be threatened anymore. The days passed and the weather was perfect as it can be only on the Highveld. My daughter studied for her medical degree at the university just down the road, and my son attended day school. Then one day events changed again, dramatically, as the Air Force appeared, sweeping across the mackerel sky in a wide swathe. High above, a great spaceship hovered at 19,000 meters of altitude, flashing in the morning sunlight. The jets, scrambled from Waterkloof Air Force Base to investigate, were unable to climb above 14,000 meters. They swept away to the north in battle formation, leaving long, tenuous vapor trails. The wide open sky retained the tranquility of eternity and the silent watcher high above remained, a circular starship, glowing and flashing high above the cirrocumulus. Indifferent to the excitement and consternation in the great city sprawling over the ridge of white waters, the silent watcher remained, glowing within her light field. Filled with wonder and awe, thousands of people watched and waited. Fear of the unknown entered many hearts, and the condensation trails of the fighter jets hung across the higher atmosphere like the wing feathers of the wind. Suddenly, out of the depths of space, another starship appeared. The two ships remained hovering, moving gently from side to side and up and down for a time. Then one of them made off to the south at great speed and vanished. The second great spaceship lowered a little in the clear noonday sky and then vanished also, as suddenly as it had appeared. My heart filled with joy as I watched from the spacious garden of a friend. Akin was back, and he had contacted my mind through the ether of the heavens. The warmth of his love coursed through my whole being and filled my soul with a sudden glow. My body stirred to the glory of his presence as the ocean is stirred by the winds of a heavenly calm, and the golden rays of love poured the radiance of the universe into my eyes as I gazed into the depths of blue from whence he came. Noting the radiance in my face, my friends questioned me about the spaceship. I told them it was Akin's ship, and that I would now have to go back to the mountains. Taking my leave of them, I quickly drove my MG out of the drive and back down the hill to my cottage. The shrill and strident urgency of the telephone greeted my home soft-coming, and I answered it. Elizabeth. A flying saucer over Johannesburg. What do you know? Never seen anything like it. There is bedlam here in the newspaper offices. I could hear a babble of voices from the other end of the telephone. What a row. I answered. I can't hear anything you say now. You will have to shout. We have sent our best reporters over to Pretoria to see the Air Chief of Staff. Are you going to the farm, Elizabeth? What is happening? I'm sure it will all be on the radio, I said. You must listen in. Bye, now. I have to go. I put the receiver down and told my son to pack for the farm, including soft-ing warm clothes. Then I went to my writing desk to await my sister's call. The previous evening, I remembered, had been quiet and perfect. A waxing moon had nudged up beyond the clouds on the eastern horizon. The green wealth of trees and shrubs that flowed down the hill swayed gently in a fresh wind from the east. From the zoo, the peacocks called, their plaintive notes swelling with the wind, a warning of storms to come. I noted that the sky had now cleared, even the high cirrus had gone. A cold front would come up later from the south, however. Instinctively, I looked into the sky. I could tell by reading its sheen that a change of weather was coming. The telephone trilled again, an urgent summons, and my sister's voice came through, clear and perfect. Come immediately, my dear, she said. And watch the weather. We are leaving now. Aachen would be there, I thought. My heart sang a paean of joy. Ready? I asked my son. Let's go. Right, Mum. David's excited voice answered from the depths of a jersey as he pulled it over his head. Take Susan to the MG, and I'll bring Vicky. Susan was already waiting at the door. Her fine, intelligent head was cocked to one side as she watched and listened to everything. Bred through the centuries to guard and protect, her golden body stiffened with the majesty and awareness of the collie. Vicky heard every word too. She scurried out of the kitchen with her mouth still full of food, her short corgi legs hardly able to propel her into the MG's back seat. Susan, meanwhile, waited with haughty dignity to step in after us. The mist swept up over the mountains of Natal as a cold front came in from the south, bearing the fragrance of moisture and shrouding the beauty of the hills. As we came to the fork in the road leading from the family home in the valley to my sister's farm over the mountain, I shifted the MG slowly into second gear to take the slippery mountain track. The car moved smoothly and powerfully over the rough track to the boundary gate. As we stopped, I heard the distant rumble of thunder, and my heart missed a beat. Be calm, I said to myself. Keep your cool. The nearby trees loomed and swayed in the wind, and the dark mass of Flying Saucer Hill seemed remote and forbidding through the scudding mist of clouds. Again we heard the ominous sound of thunder, sudden and lengthening from incessant lightning. I showed an outward calm as I called to David to hurry with the gate, but my heart began to beat wildly with the approach of the storm. The wind suddenly died, and as a meteorologist, I instantly recognized a muff-soft-flare draw. Caught out on the windward side of the mountain, our chance of survival would be slim indeed. Shifting the MG into first gear, I nursed her gradually up and up the long, wet, muddy track, slowly, so slowly, the powerful engine responding to my quiet and gentle handling, until at last we topped the mountain and slowly descended to the homestead nestled on the northeast slopes. An icy southwest gale ripped through the pines beside the track. As I drove into the long garage beside the farmhouse, a hailstone the size of a cricket ball hit the ground beside the MG and bounced up again through the farmhouse's kitchen window with a crash of shattering glass. In that second of ominous vacuum, I hooted three times and Mutti opened the door into the house. The lamp in his hand flared up the blackened glass in the wind sweeping through the garage. A barrage of hail blotted out all communication. My sister's face, white and drawn, appeared over Mutti's shoulder. As I stepped into the house, she put her arms around me and David in thanks soft-giving. She gathered us all into the drawing room and poured us cups of hot, delicious tea. Without a word, we sat and enjoyed the tea and but soft-tear at scones. Outside, The dreadful chaos and shattering roar of the storm went on and on. Susan and Vicky sat huddled against my legs, Susan's sensitive ears twitching at each shift in the storm's fury. My sister's dogs and cats had soft-hyphened led together under the Bechstein grand piano. We heard the hail and the shifting wind destroying the unguarded windows on the northeast side of the house. Lightning struck with a deafening roar as it destroyed the old ironbark gum on the sloping lawn, its bole riven to the ground. As the awful din lessened, my sister shouted across the tea table. "Thank heavens you made it. Jock's caught in the stable. They sheltered all the horses and cows just in time." In the wake of the terrible storm, hundreds of birds lay dead and dying. They had been caught in the uneasy hush before the onslaught. We turned the warmth of the kitchen into a casualty ward for the limp-feathered bodies, laying them in baskets. We scoured through the garden and beyond, into the fields, gathering up broken bodies. A misty rain continued in the aftermath of the hostile cloud, and writhing veils of vapor ascended from the ice-covered ground. Many trees were uprooted. Others stood limp and battered, or riven and shattered by lightning. The lovely garden, full of choice and exotic blooms, and so dear to my sis' soft-hyphened her, was gone. The glory of my awakening spread its warmth through my soul, and I sensed balanced harmony. Away to the west, the setting sun broke through the clouds over the peaks of the Drakensberg. As the clear-cut cumulus head of the storm moved away to the north, the orange-red rays of the sun picked out the glowing surface of a spaceship. It hovered in the ice-blue sky, between the towering thunderheads and the ragged mist that tore across the lower reaches with the south wind. "Akon's ship is here," I called out, slipping on a hail in my haste to reach my sister's side. I stood with her and we watched the sky with bated breath as an enormous, wraith-like ship appeared above the tower soft-hyphening thunderheads. It was the mothership, hovering in the darkening sky. I caught my breath with wonder as it slowly lowered toward the earth, its gigantic sides glistening with an unearthly radiance. Never before had the mothership come so low over the mountains. A deep longing filled my heart, and a strange foreboding spread its wings through my mind. The mothership had returned as promised, and Plea would be there. Akon was safely back, but the mothership had also come to say goodbye. Goodbye to Earth and her peoples of strange and violent ways. It would now go back to its home system, away from the dangers of the Sun's system. Time was running out for the planets of the Sun's system, which were heading toward their destiny of violence as they have done in the past. Jock came up from the stables, sliding and slipping over the hail, and kissed me. "I thought you would be aware of the dangerous cloud build-up, and that you would get here before it," he said quietly. "But I wish they, up there in the spaceship, could prevent vicious clouds like that from forming." My sister's joy, though, was overwhelming as she put her arm about Jock and watched the spaceship as it lowered still more into the darkening sky. Jock's face was a study in careful observation mixed with a sense of wonder as he watched the spaceship. A military man, an officer of high repute, he was suddenly confronted with the truth. He was the cleanest living person I had ever known, with a fantastic gentleness and humanity rare in such a high-ranking military man. He was always thoughtful and considerate of others, a trait inherited from his Scottish ancestors. He was indeed a link with the people in the spaceship. Mutti and the groom stood by in utter silence, watching. Slowly, the great spaceship moved up again toward the heavens, aglow with its propulsion force. Then suddenly it was gone, back into the far reaches of the sky. "I must go to the mountaintop," I said. "Akon will be there." Before they could answer, I was on my way back to the house to get a jersey. The cold south wind whipped about me as I stood on the some soft-hyphen mitt, but I did not have to wait long. A blue-white sphere appeared out of the dark, star-studded sky, and Akon's spaceship silently hovered close to the ground and gently landed. I reached the spaceship as Akon stepped through the automatic door. Jumping to the ground, he gathered me up in his arms and carried me into the warmth of the cabin, and the cold wind of a changing climate was shut out. Akon buried his face in my hair, whispering, "My beloved. My very own, my life, my precious woman. The seas of space will never part us, as our thoughts are forever united in the far distances of the sky. We are given this privilege of life, this electric essence to fuse and become one in the everlasting cycle of light. Our love is the divine essence of life, whereby the soul awakens to knowledge in the higher spheres. The Unisoft-verse sanctions our union. The glory of my awakening spread its warmth through my soul, and I sensed the balanced harmony of this everlastingly sweet sense as life. In that moment, the secret of life was revealed to me in the golden rays of Akon's love, but a moment late a clattering noise through the viewing lens disturbed our peace. Turning to the lens, we watched an Air Force helicopter land nearby in the projected beam of a searchlight. Akon immediately went to the control desk and pressed a button at one end of the panel. The spaceship vibrated with a high-pitched hum that sounded faintly beyond her double walls. "I do not wish to parley with military men. This is not the reason for my landing on Earth." Akon sounded annoyed, and for the first time I saw him frown. "The field of my ship has now been intensified. We are now invisible to their line of vision, owing to the bending of the light rays. I think the Air Force is aware of this trick, however. Before they come any closer, my beloved, and get harmed by these field differentials, I shall take you back to the homestead." We landed in the field beside the shattered garden. Through the hedge, I saw a light in my sister's bedroom. She would be anxious and waiting up for me. The mist had come down again like a white drape over everything. Akon carried me out of the spaceship, moving swiftly over the Slipsoft-prehale. Glancing down, I realized that he was not walking but gliding over the top of it all with smooth, uncanny swiftness. Before I could say anything, we were on the front step of the farmhouse. My sister came to the door, and gasped as she saw Akon's tall figure glowing in the dim light from the fabric of his close-fitting garment. "It's all right," we said. "It's only us." Akon immediately went to her and kissed her on both cheeks. "Whatever happens, never be afraid," he said to her. "Soon you will come to us. You are too frail and gentle for this world, which breeds a robust and earthy people devoid of higher knowledge." Turning to me, he held me close in his arms and kissed the top of my head. "The heights of Kathkin," he whispered. Swiftly, he turned and glided away into the mist. I caught a glimpse of a gravity belt around his waist before he disappeared into the fog. Strange soft hyphening our eyes toward the field, we could see nothing. The ship had moved into another dimension of time, into the higher octaves in the spectrum of light. "Come," my sister May breathed. That was the most wonderful moment of my life. She put her arm around my shoulders, took me into the kitchen and gave me a steaming mug of hot milk. There was a loud clattering noise outside. Running to a window, I was just in time to see the Air Force helicopter land on the lawn in the light of its searchlight. "Two Air Force officers are observing us very closely from the rim of the dip with binoculars." A knock on the door disturbed Jock, who was sitting beside the fire reading and listening to the radio. He turned off the radio, muttering about it doing funny things, as he went to answer the knock. A few moments later he came into the kitchen. "We have some Air Force types who have lost their way in the mist and decided to come down rather than go on in this thick fog," he said. "Can we make them some hot tea?" After making them comfortable in front of the log fire in the drawing room, I heard Jock say to them, "You chaps still looking for the spaceships?" "We were alerted, sir, to look for flying saucers in this area," answered the young captain. "Well," said Jock, "they have been over this area. I observed the big one myself, soon after that killer storm. I will give you all the information I have, but perhaps my sister-in-law may agree to help." The captain looked startled when he turned and saw me pouring out the tea, and both young men became strangely silent. "You chaps look done in," Jock said. "No need to be afraid of Liz, and as for the chap in the spaceship, He is just like one of us, only far more evolved. Just leave Liz alone, that's all. This is her own private affair, and has nothing to do with the Air Force. I know, violating our airspace and all that. Unless she decided to cooperate with you, though, there is nothing you can do. But leave her alone now, I'm warning you. She may answer your questions in a day or two. Yes, Jock is right, I said. In a few days' time, I will speak to you. I am tired now and wish to go to bed. Good night. The two officers stood up. They saluted with such precision that I felt highly honored and said so. You chaps had better dust down here for the night, Jock told them. Radio the blokes in the sky and tell them to go home and cut out the noise up there. Things are going to happen. We are living in momentous times, a part of history vital for our country. The captain looked relieved and saluted again. Thank you, sir, he said, and, turning smartly, he opened the door and went out into the white fog to his helicopter. Tendrils of mist blew into the warm room through the half-open door. The eternal mist of the mountains had cut visibility to nil. Just as well there's a wide expanse of flat lawn out there, I remarked. Enough room to maneuver a battleship on. The captain must have observed it well during daylight when he was reconnoitering the summit of Flying Saucer Hill, May replied. I watched them circling in the helicopter over the area this morning while you were on your way here. They are pretty clued up on your movements. I must say, it's wonderful to be under the wing of the Air Force. Well, I sighed as I climbed into bed. There's a reason for it. The next morning dawned with a beauty of unparalleled clarity after the storm of the day before. The mist had cleared away, and the long slopes of grassland leading to the summit of Flying Saucer Hill stretched away before me. The rolling green foothills beyond sparkled in the clear and cold atmosphere, alive within a mantle of singing grass that bowed and waved in velvet rhythm to the breath of the south wind. It chinned and rippled as the sunlight reflected on every blade. Scattered farms lay in the valleys, and in the sheltered vale beyond the hill, the gracious old house of my childhood days nestled among the trees. In the sky, a lone Harvard kept its solitary vigil, droning and Sir Soft Hyphen Kling to maintain Air Force reconnaissance. The sky is a great ocean of air, moving restlessly over our heads, a canopy of protection against the radiation beyond and a fragile thing of beauty and turbulence between us and the vast reaches of space. Earth moves in timeless rhythm, invulnerable faith, around the Sunday the Farth Soft Hyphen Omless reaches press against her surface and the planet's inhabitants, like deep sea fishes, adapt themselves to the pressure of their environment. Earth is alone and vulnerable, forever in orbit around the sun, whose light reflects a delicate blue sheen from Earth's surface like a beacon of hope in the void. Lying in the long singing grass on the top of the hill, I sensed the Chang soft hyphening rhythm of time, and I knew Akin was near. There was rushing in the grass, and Vicky nuzzled my face. Panting with satisfaction at finding me after following my scent, she lay down flat on her tummy with her short hind legs stretched out behind, cooling off and panting her happiness. Then she sat up, sniffed the wind and whined, her ears alert and waiting. Her great brown eyes softened and focused, and in a flash, I knew. Turning and looking up, I saw my beloved standing tall against the blue of sky, looking down at me with that wonderful expression of gentle love. Taking my hand in his, he helped me to my feet. We laughed together as we went down into the dip, where the beautiful ship of light rested on the ground. The shining spaceship was exotic and unearthly. I stopped, spell soft hyphen bound, filled with wonder and awe at the proximity of such a ship and what it meant to me. My hand trembled in Akin's as the wonder of it all impressed my mind with indelible clarity, and I looked at Akin standing tall beside me, his eyes loving and tender and a gentle smile creasing his clear-cut features. My mind imprinted forever his tall lithe form, the fine strength of his face, his hair, the high forehead, his every expression. Yes, my beloved, it is all real, very real, and I am real too, He was soft-paired, and gathered me up in his arms. He stepped onto the hull of his spaceship, passed through the doorway and placed me on the soft bench inside the cabin. Then he returned for Vicky, who made herself quite at home sniffing round the cabin, until her quick canine mind told her it was bad manners and she lay down with a guilty look in her eyes. Akin gave her a fig, and she ate it with an air of the utmost devotion, watching him all the time with her soft brown eyes. "We have other visitors outside," Akin remarked. "Two Air Force officers are observing us very closely from the rim of the dip, with binoculars soft-lars. I saw them before I carried you into the ship. You were so completely absorbed with wonder, my dear, that I did not wish to startle or upset you. Now, we depart instantly to the high plateau of Kathkin, where we shall not be disturbed anymore." Akin approached the circular wall, and a door slid open. "Come, my beloved," he said. "Within you will find a change of cloth soft-ing. Your shoes are wet from the grass on the hill, and you will feel more comfortable if you relax now." He turned back to the control panel as I rose and passed through the doorway and into a narrow, curved cabin that was part of the dome. Sun soft-light streamed in through the portals onto the rose-red carpeting. Long double mirrors between the ports reflected my movements as I entered. On the right side of the cabin, a raised platform merged with the curved wall. It was covered in shimmering silk of the same glorious rose-red color as the carpet, and at the other end of the long cabin a sunken bath glowed like a mother-of-pearl, giving out a light of its own. Beside it stood a low, comfortable lavatory seat, its base glowing like the bath and the seat made of a smooth rose material. I relaxed immediately as I absorbed the beauty and harmony of the reflected vibration of rose and gold from the glowing light of mother-of-pearl walls. How delightful it was to take off my ghillie shoes, the thick tartan kilt and hot twin set, and stand naked in the glorious and invigorating atmosphere of the spaceship. There was an elusive perfume like the tang of the sea wind. Going to the sunken bath, I pressed a golden disc set in the pearl wall of the bath. Instantly, green foaming water gurgled up. Startled, I pressed another disc to stop it, but a fine shower landed on my head. When I pressed a third disc, the shower stopped and the foaming water surged to a stop just below the rim and automatically lowered through a run out below the rim. Stepping down, I reveled in the cool, delicious water. It was soft, green and foamy, with a velvety smoothness against my skin. There was a mild taste of salt in it. I sensed that the abundance of minerals in the water must hold some secret ingredients to keep one healthy and increase lifespan, while its cleansing properties made soap unnecessary. The water was lovely, but I eventually stepped out of the bath. I wondered how I could dry myself, but as I left the tub, soft, warm air blew against my skin. Soon I was dry, my skin soft, silky and smooth, with that lovely, elusive perfume like the tang of the sea wind. Standing naked before the mirrors, I found a silver-mounted hair soft-brush. Taking down my long, golden hair, I brushed it out to dry after the shower. There was movement in the mirrors. Without a sound, Akin came behind me and put his hands into my hair, tumbling it up against his face and burying his lips into its mass. Holding me close to him, he removed a ring from his little finger and placed it over my middle finger. It was exotic and beautiful, made of beaten silver and green enamel with a great stone of light set in the middle. "It is too large for you, my beloved one. So we will place a half band of silver within it. I want you to wear it always as a part of me, to maintain our telepathic communication for all time." I could feel and sense the magic properties emanating from the ring. Akin put his hand under my chin, tilting my head up and back, and he kissed me with a long and lingering kiss on the lips. Picking me up in his arms, he carried me to the silken platform by the curved wall. Its firm softness supported our bodies with luxurious comfort, as I gave myself to the man from outer space. "Angels heaven. Dog, my beloved, my life," Akin whispered again and again, as I serenced soft-dealed in ecstasy to the magic of his love-making. Our bodies merged in magnetic union as the divine essence of our spirits became one, and in doing so I became whole. As our bodies became one, the fusion of the electric essence of life was attained, and the ensuing ecstasy and balance of electrical forces transcended all things experienced in life.